Welcome to the Speaker's Corner Show. My name is Heiko Koo. This week's show was recorded on the 11th of July 2010 at Speaker's Corner. You can come down to Speaker's Corner any Sunday afternoon and join us between noon and dusk. You can tune in at 2:30 on Fridays or 4:30 on Sundays for each week's show. Or you can visit our website at speakerscorner.net. That's speakerscorner.net.
Element of it.
The ideological element of it. Well, I mean, for example, if the Conservatives will turn around and say you've got to dramatically decrease the role and the size of the state now, then they're not going to turn around and have a formal debate internally about nationalising banks. It's not going to happen.
Yes, but you could argue.
Just to add to that, the libertarian wing of the Conservative Party is a lot more prominent within David Cameron, and what he's managed also to do is tease out that very small, I'm afraid, streak of libertarianism in the Liberal Democrats as well, which I think is quite interesting.
Just coming back to the banks, you could argue that by taking such a small and strategic sector, small in the sense of total employment, and strategic in the sense of enabling the philosophy to be carried through, if you were to take this small and strategic sector into public ownership, you could argue that it would give you sufficient leverage to implement your policies in a way that almost no other political decision could do.
But you could say that about almost every aspect of life, not just the banks.
No, you couldn't. You couldn't. That's not true.
You could. I mean, if you nationalised London buses, and you could control absolutely how London buses are ran, how it's financed, the timetables, who's employed, and so on and so forth.
You couldn't control its finance. Finance dominates all people's lives. Am I agreed?
Yeah? All right, I'm talking about individual budgets to do with the buses.
Right, but because finance dominates all people's lives, you could, for example, you could control the buses through finance. The bank, for example, could lay down terms and conditions on which a bus company must operate. Whereas a bus company can't turn around and say to a bank.
Oh, okay, you're looking at it like that. Okay, all right. So, I understand what you mean.
So in terms of strategic power, the banking system is an instrument which any government, conservative or Labour or communist or liberal, could use, if it so chose, as an instrument of policy. And have done over the past. I mean, it's not just in England that they've had nationalised banks, you know, or in China or in Russia. They had nationalised banks even in England, in France, in other countries as well. So why is it you must have private banks? I don't think you've adequately dealt with the question.
Well, I mean, are you saying this as a pointed question to me, or is it something that you genuinely don't know?
Can I ask you, to consider the possibility
of shout any louder.
federations of communities involving hundreds of small businesses who on a credit loan basis, like they have all over the world, working together to supply necessary cash when it's needed as an adjunct to the erosion of the traditional banking system?
That's a slightly different question. I think it's valid to argue that you should have these type of credit unions and so on. But my opinion is that you need to resolve the core question, and that is the domination over the entire economy of the world of private banking.
It exists because people believe in it.
I don't think that's quite true.
So you're saying people don't believe in the authoritarian system that we are under at the present time? You're saying that...
That's not quite the same argument as what you said originally. The idea that a system exists because people believe in it does not mean that because a system exists, people believe in it. It's two different concepts. People are born into a system and therefore are educated that it is natural and normal. They come to accept out of a status quo condition, and because they're not overthrowing it, that it is normal. And so it's abnormal to argue, as I do, for example, that the existing structure of wealth and power should be overthrown. And because it's abnormal to conceptualize it like that, it doesn't mean that people don't believe that things should be run the way I want things to be run. But it merely means that in order to get there, people believe that the type of change that would be necessary to get there is some abnormal aberration. And therefore, they live within the system as best they can. And the fact they don't challenge it doesn't mean they believe in it. It means they just live within it.
Get used to it.
Yeah. You know, someone said to me a little while ago, a friend of mine from Speaker's Corner, if you have some little chicks and when they hatch, you know, they'll follow you. You're a human being, but they'll follow you.
Yeah, that's
you know, if there's a story in the newspapers or in the BBC today, on the internet,
must be true,
that says there's a gull. Anyone see the story? Seagull story? Seagull that lives as a cat. Because it was nurtured, it fell through the chimney in someone's house and was raised with the cats.
I appreciate the points you're making about cultural conditioning.
That doesn't mean I'm saying you're Pavlov's dog. But
no, absolutely. I appreciate very much the points you're making about cultural conditioning. Yes, certainly. It's one of the planks of which belief systems is only a part. But at the same time, a lot of people really honestly believed that by turning out to put a cross on a piece of paper back in May to make the mark of the illiterate on a piece of paper, for which we are given the privilege every 4 years, that they
or
live in a democracy, or 5 years, or six, that people actually believe they live in a democracy, which is only part of the problem.
It's also only partly untrue. It's partly true and it's partly untrue. We live in a democracy in which all the decisive levers of power are out of democratic control.
Yeah.
So, for example, the question of the banking system,
absolutely,
or the question of the institutions which govern society, in general, are not controlled by the population.
No.
Nor, actually, do the population participate in controlling those institutions that are available to them.
The illusion is perpetuated at different levels.
That's true. And I think that's because the framework of society under capitalism has its historical genesis and development in a form of dictatorial power, which gradually ceded elements of democratic control over hundreds of years and through protests, which at their peak perhaps threatened power, but at their peak is only one phase. You know, during the war, the phase, the build up to the war in Iraq, there was a big demonstration here. Some of you were on the demonstration. The big demonstration was probably the peak of the possible resistance to that war. Once that peak was reached, there was a feeling that began to engulf all those people who had joined that protest that there was nothing you could do anyway. It doesn't matter what you do, you can't stop things.
Well, I mean, if you see that, again, you've got to look at the culture in which all that is happening. Because I'm not saying what's happened in other countries where they had tens and thousands of people out in the streets is such a good political system. The trouble with the people in this country is they are so bloody polite. Yeah, I was there with my three children from different parts of the world and friends and comrades from all. We had nearly 2 million people in the streets of London. And what did we do at the end of it? We went home for tea. Because we are English, we are so polite.
Well, it was a cold day.
It was, oh, exactly. You were there, sir. You were there. We're just too polite.
Well,
but
I mean, I'd say it's quite a general phenomenon. I think there's an element of truth in what you're saying. That's a historical genesis as well.
Oh, yes.
The struggle for the right to vote, the struggle for the right to strike, the struggle for all these things take place in a, if you like, you can look at the historical dates at which these events occurred, and you can say, well, that was a high point. You know, I was at a meeting yesterday, I was asked to go and debate with someone, and people say, well, that's the high point. They always refer, all the leftists refer to certain events, you know, in history. The revolution, 1968, and the workers were on the barricades and so on and so forth, which is all true. But then they refer to it, and all those who remember those events get starry-eyed. Tears come to the eyes of a few. And then the fact of the matter is that in the everyday life that we live today, that type of activity has declined.
Absolutely.
And therefore, there is an element, which of course, those activists or those people who like to see those type of events reoccur, imagine that those events, if you like, can find some permanent encapsulation in some formation. There is within the Bolshevik tradition, or Trotskyist tradition, which I was speaking on yesterday, what is Trotskyism? There is within that movement a tendency to believe...
I'm surprised you're not still
there. I wasn't all that welcome to the meeting. Well, I was. I was welcome when I came to speak. But at the end of the meeting, my opponent turned around and said, what this man wants is a prison, and you're all going to be in it. And I thought, that's not really what I said, you know. But he evidently didn't agree with me, and he felt, because I'd sort of undermined, someone came up to me at the end and gave the reason for this, and he said, you attack too many sacred cows in one go. And they couldn't cope with it. They couldn't cope with it.
Have a nice day.
He said you should have stuck to one or two.
Right.
And that's the training you get at Speaker's Corner. To be fair, I do, at Speaker's Corner, deal with a lot of different arguments all at once. And I find that often people, conservative or liberal or non-political people, businessmen or whatever, they will come out with an argument that is more apposite and important to answer than my fellow leftist communists will come out with in a meeting I have with them. Because after all, you're supposed to be, Marxism is supposed to be, an ideological tool for the liberation of the masses of society. And therefore you're dealing with the questions that emerge in the minds of the whole of the population, not only your own constituency. And I do find too often that I'm tied down by people in my own constituency to discussions which they think maybe are correct discussions, and others they think are taboo, should never be discussed. So for example, over the years as I've discussed this question, just the same as our friend here a minute ago indicated that the discussion within the Conservative Party about nationalizing the banks is almost like a taboo. You're basically saying that's not something someone could even discuss without being frowned upon or looked upon like a nutter. A friend of mine used to say at Speaker's Corner, because I went with a camera once, and I went over to the policeman who I know this guy to talk to, you know. And I went up to him and I said, PC, I wanted to say his name, I said, can you give me a quick interview? And then he went, no, I can't do that. I said, come on, just a couple of minutes interview about Speaker's Corner. No, I can't do that, can't. If you get permission from Western, from the main office, then I'll talk to you. And then my friend turned around and said, well, what do you expect? He says, you know, people are conditioned in certain ways of behavior. If the policeman, goes back to the police station 400 yards away from here and goes back and he says to them, you know what, over lunch, you know what, I was listening to that Marxist guy at Speaker's Corner, he made a lot of sense, you know. If he turns around and says that to them, they're going to go, yucky little...
Yeah. Why didn't your socialism work in the Soviet Union? I mean,
a lot of the ideas. That's
taboo. And somehow... You're opening up a can of worms there, mate.
Is that a sacred horse?
No, not at all. Not at all. Not at all, no, you're welcome.
So why
You're welcome, but I'm not going to answer you. Oh, no, not the same over again. All you want to know about is the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I've been born there.
You've been born there. I was born here.
Okay.
So what do you want to blame me for the Soviet Union? Why don't we blame you?
China, you know, Israeli kibbutz.
Oh, Albania, Israeli kibbutz as well.
Whatever, anything. Anything is total failure.
Well, firstly, I don't think it's quite accurate. A total failure?
Yep.
Total failure in what respect?
Any respect, like economically, socially, even scientifically.
Total failure
means 100%.
One sec.
Okay.
The gentleman here,
don't be objective like that,
who agrees that the Soviet Union was a failure.
It was not a failure artistically.
He said something different.
He disagrees.
Why did the economic and political system collapse?
Right, yeah. Right.
I think that's
a far more apposite question than arguing that everything was a total failure. I mean, the Egyptian society was failed. But it wasn't a total failure.
The vast majority of Roman society failed.
Well, I don't have the capacity to ask the vast majority of Soviets. I have asked quite a lot of people at Speaker's Corner who came from the former Soviet Union, and there's a very mixed opinion. A very mixed opinion. I think you would agree, if you're honest, that there is a mixed opinion about this.
There is a small minority probably.
Right, so not everybody agrees that the Soviet Union was a complete failure. So the question, was it a spiritual failure? I will try and answer that in conjunction with answering the gentleman's question here. The Soviet Union collapsed, I think primarily because it was incapable of meeting the material desires and needs of the population. I think that's the primary reason why it failed, why it collapsed.
Spending everything on military.
I don't think it's just...
Everything again.
I don't believe...
total everything.
Well, I don't... Okay, qualify it. I don't believe it is because they spent large amounts on the military that they failed. I think it's a contributory factor, but I don't believe it's the reason. If you want to find a primary reason, or even the secondary reason why the Soviet Union collapsed, or the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. I believe there are a number of specific phenomena which you could name, including too high a military budget, lack of democratic participation, a lack of spiritual satisfaction, repressive bureaucratic apparatus, an increasing size of the bureaucratic apparatus, and the consumption that that apparatus had reaching a very high proportion of the total surplus produced by the workers, a failure to adequately deal with agricultural sensitivities of the requirements of agriculture, production of agriculture, a failure to meet the consumer needs of the population, a failure to allow participation by the workers over the administration of production. But also, and I think this is one of the key elements that is verifiable today, is that they centralized far too much of the economy in state hands. In my opinion, in the 1920s, they should never have accepted, although this was not a choice, the pathway which Stalin adopted of mass collectivization in 1928 to 1931. I believe that the majority of small-scale operations in the period of transformation from capitalism or pre-capitalism to socialism should be characterized by the majority of the small-scale operations remaining private, and only the commanding heights of the economy being publicly owned. And then those commanding heights of the economy, in my opinion, should be democratically administered with the maximum participation possible of the working class, of the producers, and the consumers. And gradually, as you increase the productive potential of the economy and draw in larger and larger numbers of people into unified economic operations by scale, then you can have greater participation of the population in administering those elements of the economy that are large scale and plannable. And by that I mean the banks, the major industries, the utilities, transportation, the fundamentals of large scale economics. Those, I believe, should be publicly owned. And I think there's verification that such an economic structure, had it been adopted, would not have led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union could have been economically more powerful than China is today, had it not had a collapse in 1991 and had their economy been based upon a similar economic balance between the private and state sector as you have in China. That leaves aside the question of democratic control. I believe if it was democratically controlled at the same time as having the dominant sections of the economy, large-scale industry and the banks in public ownership, and the rest of the economy in private or semi-private ownership, then China and the Soviet Union together by now would have been ahead of America and Europe. I believe that is the case. And I believe that China's verification of that.
Oh, come on, come on. I know you are, what you are going to say. You are going to say human nature.
He's saying that's not the case.
Yeah, yes, you see.
Okay, but no, but the specifics. The specifics.
You started to count the faults. What was wrong then? That was wrong. And the main fault, I think, from my perspective, was that it's just not natural. You can't ask people to share everything, okay?
Yeah, but that's not what I'm saying. I think it's quite clear from what I said that I didn't say that.
But that's the core of communism.
Did I say you can ask everybody to share everything?
No, but
I didn't. What I said was, in response to the gentleman's question, which was very specific, why did the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe collapse? Collapse. Now, I gave quite specific answers. There might be other answers, but I gave quite specific answers. Now, I also argued that if those reasons had not existed, or even some of those reasons had not existed, in other words, you could have continued with a dictatorship at the same time as allowing the key sectors of the economy to remain in public hands and small scale operations to be privately run, individual greed, individual need, individual appropriation, contradiction with communism. That relationship, such as you've got in China, would have meant, in my opinion, I think there's verification in the way China developed, that had the Soviet Union done what China did, the Soviet Union and China together would have been stronger than America and Europe. That's my argument. Now, you can argue against that.
Is China's market socialism at all?
No.
I mean, I spoke to a taxi driver in China. This was World Cup days. And he said, do you like football? I says, no, I don't like football. I asked him, what do you like? And he thought for a while. He said, you know what I like? I like money. He liked money. And this was communist China for me.
Well, communist China is not communist, just the same as communist Soviet Union was not communist either. In fact, neither the Soviet Union nor China argued they were communist. They argued that they were in a transition between capitalism and communism, something they called socialism, or in East Germany, where I used to live, they used to call it real existing socialism. I don't agree with that definition either. I don't think they were socialist. I don't think they were capitalist. I think they're in a transition between capitalism and socialism. They were neither socialist nor capitalist. They had elements of both systems within them. What does that mean? It means that they had the law of value, which Marx explained. Basically, workers work to produce wealth. When they work to produce wealth on modern machinery, they produce a surplus over and above what it takes to feed them, clothe them, house them. that surplus is utilized for investments in other spheres, either the private sector or whatever. Wages are paid according to their value. In other words, according to what it takes to bring someone back to work, pay for the housing, healthcare, education, and so on. There's slightly different levels in different countries, but that's what Marx called the law of value. Goods are determined, their value is determined by the amount of socially necessary labor time to produce them. So they're sold on the marketplace as commodities. Now, in the Soviet Union, there were attempts to overcome these laws, but when you attempt to overcome these laws, the laws still affect you, unless you've surpassed the productive requirements of capitalism. What does that mean? It means like this. If I say that bread is going to be priced at 1 kopeck for a kilogram, or 10 pence for a kilogram, it means that unless there's sufficient bread for everybody, some people are going to buy the 10 kopeck or 1 kopeck loaves of bread, or 10 pence loaves of bread, and are going to sell them for 50 pence, because they can. Because there is a demand and there is a supply question which meets only at the point where they cross-sect. Unless, of course, you've got such a superabundance of bread that you don't have to charge anything for it. In which case, and in some circumstances, that did pertain. But then even then there are distortions. For example, in East Germany, bread was very cheap. It was a few pfennig to buy a loaf of good quality bread. There was not a shortage of bread in East Germany. In fact, what happened was that because bread was so cheap, subsidized by the state at a very low rate since 1971, what happened was that you could buy bread, and they produced enough, more than enough bread. And so what happened was, what do you imagine?
People went to the west.
Sorry? No, no, not west.
You can follow an argument.
No, no, this has nothing to do. You couldn't. Hang on.
You
couldn't go to the west in those days, right? So that was not possible. No. What happened was that pig farmers fed their pigs on bread, because it was cheaper to buy bread from the bakery and feed your pigs that than it was to buy pig food. And in that way, of course, some pig farmers did that on the black. Because, you could go to the bakery, make an agreement with the bakery, get the bread from the pig farm, say that you bought bread from bought pig fodder. That way you could make the difference yourself and pocket the money. And so if you don't abide or allow the basic conditions of market price determination, you have to be pretty sure that the consequences will be positive for the development society.
That was the Speaker's Corner show for this week. Come down to Speaker's Corner and join us, speak, listen, or discuss any Sunday afternoon in Hyde Park, Speaker's Corner near Marble Arch. Or you can tune in on 104.4 Resonance FM every Sunday at 4:30, every Friday at 2:30. Or visit our website, speakerscorner.net.
He was expelled.